Okay, great. Well, thank you for the kind introduction and the opportunity to be here today. Thank you, Prabal, for the invitation. I understand I have 2 hours to speak. Nothing worse than an economist for more than 20, 25 minutes. Sound okay? And if there's any questions, we can do that for 5, 10 minutes. Okay. Good. I'm going to make three broad points in my remarks. The first is the foreclosure crisis continues on. The pipeline of foreclosed properties is full. You can see that here. This shows the number of first mortgage loans that are in foreclosure or clearly headed in that direction, 90 days and over delinquent. If there are loans that are that far along, the probability that they go into foreclosure is very high. This is based on credit file data that we collect from Credit Bureau Equifax at the end of each month. I think the last data point in the chart is for the last week of July. So 4.1 million first mortgage loans are in this predicament. Just to give you context, in our data, there are approximately 49 million first mortgage loans outstanding. So gives you a clear sense of the magnitude of the problem. There's been four waves of foreclosure. Wave number one was 2006. Those were the flippers when the market began to turn and it became clear they couldn't make a quick buck. They turned their keys back to their lenders, went from being current on their loan straight into a default. Wave number two was 2007. That was the subprime reset problem. This was when interest rates were still high before the Federal Reserve began lowering interest rates. These are most of the subprime loans are two-year ARMs. Those that were originated in 2005 hit their first payment reset in 2007. The increase in monthly payments was unaffordable, and many of these borrowers defaulted. Wave number three began in late 2007, early 2008, and it continues on through the current period. This is the combination of negative equity with unemployment and underemployment. By my calculation, based on the credit file data, there are just over 14 million homeowners that are in negative equity positions, so that the value of their home is less than the mortgage debt they owe on the home. And just another statistic, 9 million of those are underwater by more than 20%, so very deeply underwater. Of course, you mix 14 million underwater homeowners with 15 million unemployed and another 10 million underemployed, that's a pretty lethal mix and obviously the fodder for significant foreclosure problems. We're now entering into wave number four, and that's what's being called strategic default, the idea being that homeowners can, under reasonable assumptions, make their mortgage payments but find it financially unpalatable to do so. Those are the folks that are deeply underwater by more than 20%. It's hard to get a grip on the magnitude of that problem, but it is now meaningful and increasing. The best estimates I've seen put it at about 20% of defaults now are strategic, and it is rising. So the foreclosure problem is still in full swing. And it is translating and will continue to translate into more REO. This is my estimate of the number of loans that are in REO from the first quarter of 2008 through the second quarter of 2010. You can see that the peak was back in late 08, 08 Q3, 08 Q4. It did come down through late last year. But it is now picking up again. Last couple of quarters, the number of REO properties is beginning to rise. One interesting development is that the number of REO on loans that are in securitized pools, subprime, Alt-A, jumbo pools, is declining, right? So if you go back to late 08, you can see that almost 400, a little over 400,000 of REO property were in the securitized pool, and we're now down to 200,000. And I get to see this data on a monthly basis because of Moody's. They collect the data for obvious reasons, and it is now falling relatively rapidly. But unfortunately, the REO from Fannie, Freddie, FHA, and what's sitting on bank balance sheets is now rising, and rising more than the decline in REO and securitized pools. So the total is now beginning to increase. And I suspect, given that previous chart of the number of loans that are in the foreclosure process, we will see REO inventory continue to rise as we make our way through the remainder of this year into 2011. So the crisis continues on. No sign that it has peaked yet. That's point number one. I said there were 23 points I'd like to make. No, three. Point number one being that the foreclosure crisis is in full swing. Point number two, unfortunately, all this implies further house price declines. We're not done, I think, in terms of the price weakness. The key statistic for house prices is the share of home sales that are distressed, that are foreclosure sales coming out of REO or short sales. You can see that here, maybe this is only a chart an economist can love, but it is very, very informative for didactic purposes. The green line right-hand scale represents house price growth. Now, this is the quarter-to-quarter change annualized on a percentage basis, right? And this is a Q1 2006 through Q2 2010. That Q2 2010 value was my estimate. We just got the actual value yesterday. This is based on Case-Shiller data. And the increase in Q2 actually was a bit stronger than I'm estimating here. So that was a little bit stronger. But you can the orange line, left-hand scale, represents the change in the share of home sales that are foreclosure sales. This is data from Zillow. And you can see the very strong, clear inverse relationship between the two. So when, you know, very intuitive, when the share of sales that are home sales that are distressed is rising, then you will see price declines. You will note that we've had some price stability over the past year. If you go back over the period, going back into the spring, summer of 2008, house prices have been relatively stable. Been up or down a bit month to month or quarter to quarter, but generally stable. And that goes to the fact that the share of home sales that were distressed actually declined during that period, going back to that REO graph. That's partly related to fewer REO sales, but it's also in part related to the fact that non-distressed sales were also relatively strong, in large part related to policy efforts, efforts by the Federal Reserve to lower mortgage rates, and also three rounds of housing tax credit. So the share of sales that were distressed over the past year has actually come down, and that's provided a little bit of stability. But going forward, things are now moving in the wrong direction. REO is rising. That means more REO sales are coming. And as importantly, the number of non-distressed home sales has fallen very, very sharply on the backside of the tax credit. If take a look at the recent data, the July data, existing home sales fell to 3.83 million units annualized. That's about as low as it's been since early 1995. Now, some of that is just simply the fact that a lot of sales were pulled forward because of the tax credit. It may also be in part people are waiting for the next tax credit. The policymakers might, if they've given us three tax credits, maybe they'll come up with a fourth. So it might be logical for people to hang tough for a month or two or three to see if they don't get another credit. But regardless, we've seen non-distressed sales come down. So the share of home sales that are distressed is now beginning to rise, and I think it strongly argues for more price declines. And you can see my forecast here. This shows the Case-Shiller National House Price Index. It is an index indexed to equal 100 at the beginning of the previous decade. You can see the boom, the bubble in the mid part of the last decade. And then, of course, the crash. House prices from peak to trough have fallen about 30%. You can see the relative price stability over the past year, and you can see my forecast. So I do expect another 5% decline in house prices from the previous trough. So peak to trough, price declines are going to come in around 35%. From the Q2 value to the trough, we're going to see another 7-8% decline, but peak to trough in total, about 35%. Now, this outlook is predicated on a number of key assumptions. One assumption is that interest rates remain low. So the fixed mortgage rate today is about, according to Freddie Mac, 4.3%. I'm assuming that the fixed mortgage rate averages 4.5% through the end of 2011. So that's a key assumption. The other is that the job market hangs together reasonably well, that we don't see outright consistent declines in jobs. That assumption, I think, is the best, most likely scenario, but it is a pretty shaky forecast at this point. Looks like the job market is beginning to weaken again. In terms of unemployment, today's unemployment rate is 9.5%. I do expect it to trend higher over the course of the next 6-9 months back into double digits and to be back closer to 9.5% by the end of 2011. So modest job growth, but some job growth is very important. And the third assumption, and I'll come back to that to this in just a minute, is that the policy efforts to mitigate foreclosure are reasonably successful, that the HAMP modification effort will ultimately result in approximately 1 million in permanent mods. Just to give you context, we're just over 400,000 in permanent mods to date, so we're going to have to see some improvement, but I'll come back to that in a second. The price outlook does vary considerably across the country. You can see that in the map. This shows the nation's 380-plus metropolitan statistical areas across the country. The parts of the country that are not shaded are rural areas, non-metro areas. This, again, is based on mostly Case-Shiller data, but where their data isn't available, I've used FHFA data. The metropolitan areas where price declines from Q1 2010 to the bottom are going to be greater than 5% are in red, and these are the same areas of the country that have been hardest hit, Florida, California, Arizona, Nevada, indeed much of the West, parts of New Jersey around New York, and of course in distressed parts of Michigan. And this goes back to the point that the key statistic for house prices is the share of home sales that are distressed. The red areas are the areas where that share is going to rise most significantly in coming months. At least that's our expectation. One other point about house prices. This is a very fragile forecast. It can devolve pretty quickly. If house prices fall a bit more than I'm anticipating and more homeowners end up in negative equity positions than expected, then that could result in more defaults, more house price declines, and we'll get right back into that vicious self-reinforcing cycle down that we were in a couple, 3 years ago. So it's what I would consider to be a forecast that's right on a razor's edge. If anything slightly goes wrong in the script, we'll be right back into the soup. Now, that's point number two, and you should be thoroughly depressed. Right? Okay. So point number three is an effort to cheer you up a little bit. There are some good things happening, and I'm going to go through them. I'm going to mention three very positive things that should give us some sense of hope that while we've got more work to do, it's not over, the coast is not clear, we're getting closer to the end of this process than the beginning. Let me go through them for you. First, I think housing inventory has peaked. The number of vacant homes that are for sale, rent, or held off the market is extraordinarily high. You can see that in the chart. The green line is the actual number of vacant homes. The last data point from Census is Q1 2010. Just about 10 million homes were vacant. The orange line represents an estimate of trend, so that would be a good approximation of what kind of a vacant inventory we should have in a reasonably well-functioning housing market. So the difference between the two, the actual and the trend, is a pretty good guesstimate of the excess housing inventory in the economy. And, take 10 million, actual trend 8.5 million, that suggests what? About 1.5 million vacant properties that are in excess. The back-of-the-envelope calculation in the chart, in the the northwest quadrant of the chart, shows you how we might work off that inventory. Housing supply is incredibly depressed. Single-family construction, multifamily construction, manufactured housing currently is running about at about a 600,000 unit annualized pace, and you can see how that's broken out in the chart. That's about as low as it's been since World War II, incredibly depressed levels of construction supply. Housing demand, that is also very depressed given the tough economy, but it is, by my estimate, running measurably above supply, 1.35 million units annualized. You can see how that breaks out, household formations of about 800K, obsolescence, what you need to replace the stock of homes that are becoming obsolete or get wiped out by hurricanes or tornadoes, and second homes. The difference between demand and supply is about 750,000 units, right? So if demand and supply do not change going forward, how long will it take to work off 1.5 million vacant units? 2 years. 2 years. So you have to wait until mid-2012 before you can conclude that things are reasonably back to normal. Now, My sense is that we'll get there sooner than that. I think it's very likely that demand will pick up more quickly than supply. The builders are under significant financial pressure, can't get credit, and there's no appetite to increase supply quickly. But demand, I think, will improve. As the job market begins to engage, we get more job growth, we'll see households form more quickly. In fact, one could argue that there's pent-up household formations developing. I can personally attest to this fact. People are doubling up, tripling up, and as soon as there's an opportunity for those households to break apart, they do, because it's pretty difficult for everyone to live together in those households for an extended period of time. In fact, you can you can see that in the recent data. The recent improvement in the job market since the beginning of the year, there was a very nice seeming pickup in household formations. A lot of that went into rental property, and actually the apartment market has improved quite noticeably since the beginning of the year. So there could be a point in time when the job market is really kicking into gear, say 2012, when we could get a lot more household formations than we're anticipating, and we can work off that inventory much more quickly. One other quick reason for some optimism here on the inventory front is that the inventory problem is very regionally concentrated. Florida is just rife with a surfeit of inventory around Atlanta, coastal South Carolina, Vegas, Arizona, Central Valley of California. But if you go into other parts of the country, the inventory problem is measurably less significant. So we're going to work through that excess inventory much more quickly, and that will lay the foundation for a much healthier housing market with better job growth. So reason number one for some optimism is that the inventory problem, I think, is at a peak. Reason number two, housing is, in my view, now fairly valued, at least if you look at house prices relative to household incomes or effective apartment rents. And just to give you a sense of that is this graphic. This shows the percent over or undervaluation of single-family housing nationwide based on those two metrics. So I've created a measure of valuation that's a weighted average of price to income and price to rent, again, using the Case-Shiller National Index. And you can see by my calculation that house prices are roughly where they should be relative to household income and rent. That doesn't mean that we can't see more house price declines and we overshoot and see property markets go into a position of undervaluation as they were back in the late 1990s when the California housing market was particularly depressed. But it is a reason for some optimism. One other quick point. Take a look at the degree of overvaluation at the height of the housing bubble in the mid part of the last decade, about 50%. That's nationwide. That's nationwide. So that means some markets were measurably more overvalued. And just a quick tangent. You know, I was doing the same kind of analysis back in the middle of the housing bubble, and I was looking at these charts and saying, you know, the implications here are that house prices are going to fall, you know, 60-70% in Miami. And unfortunately, I didn't stick to the models, and I said, we can't say house prices are going to fall 60, 70%, because if I say that, no one's going to believe me, and I'm going to lose all credibility. So I said 30, 40%. I wish I had stuck to my guns and said 60, 70%. But it is a lesson, and now going forward, I'm sticking to my models. And that's a reason for some optimism, Finally, the third reason for a bit of optimism is policy. I think policy is now engaging. You know, I think it's been frustrating, difficult to get the policy machinery working. This is an incredibly complex problem. You know this better than I do. Just getting our minds around the problem and then measuring the magnitude of the problem and then designing effective policies and then implementing those policies is incredibly difficult, But you know what? I think we're there. I think we're right on the cusp of making a meaningful difference. And I think the HAMP effort has been reasonably successful. It's not been as successful as the president had hoped when he introduced the plan back in early 2009. We've only gotten 440,000 in permanent modifications. But that is meaningful and will make a difference. And more, and also important, as important, the HAMP plan is going through its own modification. And in the next couple, 3 months, we will see expanded incentives for modifications that will include incentives for principal write-down, getting back to the negative equity issue that I brought up earlier. And I think that's a very encouraging development. And you can see my outlook for foreclosure, short sales, and deeds in lieu going forward in the context of HAMP 1.0, that's the original HAMP plan, and now HAMP 2.0, the HAMP with the added incentives and the principal write-down component to it. So just because this is a very disconcerting topic, and I know must be very disturbing for you being in the trenches watching this on a day-to-day basis, it is going to be difficult. The coast isn't clear. The next 6, 12 months are going to be very tricky, and we're going to need some very good policymaking from the Federal Reserve and from the administration. But I do think we've made a lot of progress, and I'm sticking to my forecast. That's the end of my my remarks. I went through 3 points. I think we've now got 5 or so minutes. If anyone would like to make a comment or pose a question. Yes, ma'am.
Mark, in several slides previous to this one, you were comparing the housing supply. And so my question is, it appears that in the housing supply numbers, you're not considering foreclosure inventory. And my question is, why not? And if you did include foreclosure inventory, what kind of impact would that have on the supply-demand ratio?
Good question. With respect to the foreclosure inventory, if someone gets foreclosed on and they lose their home, they have to live somewhere. It doesn't add to the vacant stock of home. You know, they'll go rent. They can rent another single-family home, or they can rent an apartment, or they can move to manufactured housing. So it's not like that household disappears. It's there. So it doesn't add to the vacant stock. So this is just another measure of the amount of excess that exists in the housing market that's independent of the foreclosure problem. From my perspective, the foreclosure issue is very important with respect to house prices, and as going back to my point about the share of sales that are distressed. This is another aspect of the vacancy problem, the overbuilding that occurred during the bubble and the boom, that does have influence on house prices, but measurably less so. It would. You didn't hear the question. If a fair number of, she was asking, will the Phillies win the World Series? The answer is yes. I am a Philadelphia native. Yes. She asked if a fair number of those people who lose their homes go back and double up and triple up, would that affect the results? The answer is yes, that would. my household formation number would be lower. But it is already depressed, and it is reflective of that occurring already. So I am accounting for that in that 800,000 estimate or guesstimate. It could be worse. You know, we could see more doubling or tripling up than we've had to date, and then this estimate would be too high. But, you know, this does account for that already. Yeah.
Understanding that multifamily is a subset of these data, are you seeing anything significant in the multifamily sector that might not jump out in what you've just said?
Well, yeah, I mentioned earlier, to my surprise, that the multifamily sector has seen has been strong, relatively strong, certainly relative to the single-family market over really since the beginning of the year. Since we saw the job market go from losses to gains, we've seen some pickup in formation and some breaking apart of those double, tripled-up homes, and a lot of those folks have gone into rental property. So absorption of rental space has picked up, and vacancy rates have fallen in most markets. And in fact, effective rents are rising. They've risen quite considerably since the beginning of the year. So the rental market is in pretty good shape, surprisingly good shape, compared to my expectation, most people in the industry's expectation at this point. A lot does depend on the job market. If the job market goes from positives back into negative territory, then we got a problem. Household formations are going to slow again, and that's going to be reflected in weaker absorption in the apartment market. But barring that, the baseline being continued modest job growth, the apartment market is measurably healthier. Yeah. Now, effective rents, that accounts for concession. So most of the improvement in effective rents has been just winding down the concessions that landlords were providing to get people into rental property. And, of course, the level of rent is measurably lower than it was prior to the recession. So, you know, the net income that's being generated on these properties is measurably lower than it was, but nonetheless it's moving in the right direction. So that's a very positive development, I think. I think we have time for one more comment, question, if there is one. Anything bothering you? No? Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.